This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, welcome to UCSB's Distinguished Lecture Series. We have Barry Bergman with us tonight. Awesome, awesome story, both personally and professionally. I can't wait to share some of it with you. Barry studied at Duke University, and when he was done with his studies, he opened a record store called The Record Bar. It was actually the second record store in that chain. Ran with a couple stores for a number of years, figured it out, dialed it in, learned the business, and he eventually rolled those two stores into the second largest record chain in the country, nearly 200 stores in 30 states. Timing is everything in life and love. And Barry nailed the timing of the exit of that company. He sold the company in 1989 for nearly $100 million. Took some time off, had some fun, did some things in the record industry, managed some bands, produced some records, started a record label, got a little antsy, and decided he wanted to do it again. He found a small four-store chain that was selling cosmetics that was going bankrupt. He took over that organization, closed two of the stores, took the remaining two stores. Sound familiar? Took the remaining two stores and built it into one of the world's largest fashion brands, Bare Essentials. He grew that business to the point where he sold it for $200 million. It went on. The foundation that Barry and his partner had built went on to, as you guys know, become one of the largest fashion brands on the globe. And so Barry's not a one-hit wonder, unlike many of the bands he sold from his record store. He's not a one-hit wonder. He's had multiple hits. Barry's also quite the philanthropist. So, yes, he's been very successful in business. He's also been very giving of his time. He's a trustee here at UC Santa Barbara, where he's given a tremendous amount of his time in that capacity. He also serves on the bowl of the Santa Barbara, on the board of the Santa Barbara Bowl, which is our premier music venue here in town, which we're very thankful for his efforts there. And he also gives a lot of time, effort, and energy to UCSB's Arts and Lectures organization, where he helps curate the great speakers and acts that come in to our community, which I'm extremely grateful for. Barry did not do all of this alone, and very few people in this world achieve this kind of success alone. Barry has had a lifelong partner since he was a teenager, and I actually want to introduce her to you right now. Arlene is with us here today. Let's give her a hand. You know what they say, behind every successful man, well, she's sitting right here today. They really have been lifelong partners. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have Barry here. Obviously, he's got a great entrepreneurial story to tell you, and we will talk about that story. But he also embodies what I think is absolutely paramount for you as young people to internalize. And that is, you can have it all. You can be a successful business person and be very successful in your private life. You can sit here after a lifelong career and have your life partner here with you, supporting you, being with you day in, day out, having a great family, great children, great grandchildren around you. And that's what Barry's been able to do. And Barry wrote a book called Nice Guys Finish First. I'm going to talk quite a bit about that book. And he is the living embodiment of the fact that nice guys can and do finish first. Let's welcome him to our class. And if anybody out there hasn't read this book, you need to check it out. It's a great combination of real hands-on and anecdotes about business, hiring people, interviewing people. And it's also got some great stories about some rock and roll celebrities, and we'll talk about a few of those tonight as well. So it's a good balance between just sheer entertainment and real hands-on tips and tricks for business. So Barry, I want to start at the beginning, or at least the beginning of your professional career. I love your story about I don't love the fact that your father went bankrupt, but I love the fact that you took that, what could have been just a complete financial meltdown for your entire family, and you guys made the best of a terrible situation. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about how you took that story of bankruptcy and turned it into the record bar?
My father had was in the wholesale grocery business, and as you said, he went bankrupt. And the only thing he was able to save out of the bankruptcy was a record store. And he didn't know anything about the record business. I had been working for my uncle. He had a store. And so I tried to teach my father about the record business, and he taught me about business. So it worked out very nicely.
How old were you when you started doing that?
I was in college, I think, and I really hated working for him. I worked for him for a long time until he finally got out of the business. And he was real critical, but he taught me a great deal. And
so did he have a jukebox enterprise?
Oh, yeah. What happened during World War II, a guy owed him some money, and he paid him off in jukeboxes. And they used to sell records out the back door of the warehouse, the records off the jukebox. They're all scratchy stuff. And so it evolved into a record store. So that's how he ended up owning a record store. It was about 30 miles away from where we lived. So it became our family livelihood. And eventually it morphed into what we did with the company.
Right. Well, I think what's interesting about your story, and I kind of alluded to it in the introduction, was you went from one to two, so you doubled in size, and then you stayed at two record stores for about 5 years. Finally, you went to your dad and said, "Hey, Dad, I think it's time for that third store," and you wanted to put it in a strange place called a mall, which I think was
they were new. Just starting to build enclosed mall shopping centers. And I told him I was not going to run a record store for the rest of my life. I was going to go to New York and work for a record company because I wanted to be around where they made the music. And so I said, either we expand or I'm gone. So we expanded and we opened the third store. We opened in a mall, and malls were just starting to happen then, and it was a tremendous success from the opening gun. So
you went from two to three and then a dozen within...
We started to double every year, and I remember thinking, boy, if we could ever have five stores, that'd be wonderful, and if we could ever have 10 stores, that would be sensational. And then about 20, I stopped doing that. But the reason I always wanted to open the stores, it wasn't about money. It was just because it was so much fun. I loved the action, and I loved what was going on. It was a great business. It was a great business to work in. It was always fun to go to work. And because it was our company, we could build it in any way we wanted to. So we built a really ethical organization that was a good place to work. And that paid off over and over and over.
Well, I think it's what's great. One of the many things that's great about being an entrepreneur is you get to create the work environment that you want to work in. It's not foisted upon you by some corporate bureaucracy or someone else. And I know in my ventures, that's one thing I really did value. I mean, there's a lot of downside to being an entrepreneur, but you can create the culture you want to live in or you want to work in, and then you have to fight fiercely to kind of maintain that culture. You guys certainly did that. Well, we met your wonderful wife, Arlene, already, and as I mentioned, she's been your business partner really from the beginning. But you guys might not understand, they worked together all those years. It wasn't as if she was baking cookies or something. She was working in the trenches running HR for this large, what ended up becoming a large corporation. So I know you guys made that work. You talk about the four rules of working together. Can you share with us sort of what those four rules were?
Well, we were really careful about taking stuff home, because when you take stuff home, you only talk about the problems. So we had a rule about not talking about stuff at home. We had all our friends work for the company, so we tried as much as we could when they came over not to talk about the business, but to talk about it, anything else. And Arlene always worked a lot harder than I did, so we'd sit in bed, and she would work, and I'd watch television. She was head of human resources.
Get up here. I want to talk to you.
Yeah. We called her the head human. So it was always interesting, but we just tried not to bring the problems of the company at home, and right. that worked out.
Right.
And that's why it worked. And we've been married for 50 years, so we understand how a partnership that way works.
Was there any questions you asked or things you did specifically during the hiring process that helped you weed out potential candidates?
Yeah, I never hired off a resume. I mean, I assumed that, you know, you could see it there. People were qualified, or at least within the framework of the lies they told. You know? But what I tried to do in an interview, and I tried to make the interviews fairly long, was to get somebody to tell me something about themselves. And first of all, there's a great interviewing technique, which is to shut up and listen and watch. Okay, most interviewers tend to talk way too much during an interview. So the idea is to get the person to talk and to get them, keep them talking, and they'll tell you a lot of stuff about themselves. And plus it's interesting, you know, if you'll just shut up and listen. So I used to really enjoy it. So I could, and I could get a feel. One thing I realized later in my career is I would get this gut feeling about whether I liked or didn't like somebody. And if I didn't like them, I wouldn't ever hire them. And I got that feeling in 15 seconds. I mean, and I have no idea what that is. It's just your brain taking in a tremendous amount of data real fast. And so when I deviated from that, I screwed up. So.
Yeah, I mean, you even call that your first rule of hiring.
Yeah.
And I think be careful with that when you're younger, because I think you reach the point where you're good at that. I think maybe when you're, I should speak for myself, but I know when I was younger, just simply going by my gut and going on whether I liked somebody or not initially didn't always work. But over time, I became much better at that, and obviously Barry did as well.
Yeah, and I was really bad at it to start with. Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that I learned is if I screwed up, I had to fire the people,
yeah.
And that was real unpleasant. So I got way better at it fast.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, I think it's like dating, right? You have a couple, a few bad dates, and then you figure it out.
Yeah, Arlene and I got together so young. I didn't have much experience of that. I was 16. Arlene was 14 when we married. When we met.
Not when they married.
Easy, yes, yes. Yeah, we're from North Carolina, but not quite that many.
So your original working title of your book was We'll Get Rich a Few Days Later, which is a sentiment that runs throughout the book. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how did you deploy that sentiment in real life, and how did it impact the company?
It was a good test. The test was if we couldn't do it ethically, honestly, and lovingly, let's not do it. We'll get rich a few days later. And it was something I thought about a lot, because there were plenty of times that we, you know, you could cut a corner or something. And I just didn't do that. And it was a good test, and I'd run over it. And I said it a lot, so people got used to it. And it worked out for us, because too many companies cut way too many corners.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you were 40 years in business as an operator. I mean, you got to take the long view of your customer relationship and not what do we do this quarter? How do we goose the number for this month?
With Bare Essentials, for instance, we're on QVC, and we did a lot of our business on QVC. That's the television they probably did $10 billion last year.
We have to explain what television is.
Yeah.
It's a big box.
Yeah, you can also get it on your computer, and they'll be glad to sell it. They sell a lot. And Bare Essentials is their number one beauty brand. But their quality and assurance people, they're the people that sort of manage the product for them. They want a long shelf life for that stuff because they warehouse all of it. So what they tried to get us to do was to put preservatives in the product. And one of the things we always said was no animal testing, no preservatives. And we thought that was the ethical way to go. And they said, if you won't put preservatives in the product, we're going to kick you off the air. And that was a really tough decision, because we didn't want to get kicked off QVC, but it was so important to us. And we knew a lot of other companies were, in fact, putting in preservatives and saying they weren't. Yeah. But we said, no, we won't do it, and they rolled. They let us stay on the air. So it worked out fine, because it could have been terrible.
Right. Yeah. Not good for you. So we'll get queue up. Raise your hand if you want to ask a question. We'll get you a microphone. I'm going to ask another one, and we'll take yours in just 1 second. So your book, in the book's in the prologue, you say, I expect this book is going to piss some people off, and if it doesn't, I'll be disappointed. Love to hear what you thought might piss some people off, and also what were some reactions to the book that might have surprised you?
Well, first of all, I was confused about what tonight was going to be. I thought this was the Donald T. Sterling racial lecture, but I'm the kind of person, I like to piss people off just out of hand, because it makes it interesting. But there are a lot of views that I've got that are not normally held by most business people. Like, I don't believe in workaholics. I don't think working 18 hours a day is a good idea. A lot of people in business do. I don't want to burn anybody out. And so those kinds of, it's almost heretical ideas. I thought maybe that would piss some people off. And I guess it probably has. I'm not everybody's cup of tea.
Well, I think it's even more remarkable. It may not be obvious to this demographic in this room or maybe the folks watching, but you weren't selling Bibles, right? I mean, the music industry has sort of a long and sordid past of payola and all kinds of...
It did?
Well, yeah, I read about it.
Yeah.
And so to come out the other side in that industry, I think, is even more remarkable because you were surrounded by a lot of people that didn't have the world's greatest ethics and were out to make a quick-term buck, just wanted to make another hit. But I think it really just shows the power, even in that industry, which would reward that in the short term, that in the long term, having this long view of good character and ethics really does pay off.
So, yeah, so much of the music business really started in New York. And it started out, a lot of guys who got into the music business were club owners to start with, and a lot of them were connected. So there were some really rough customers in the music business. And there were some guys that went to prison, and guys would get beaten up because they wouldn't do what other guys wanted them to do. So it was an interesting business. Yeah.
Another question here in front.
Yeah. I was curious, did you ever catch any of your upper-level management at Record Bar or Bear Central's acting unethically? And if so, how did you address the problem?
There's only one way. They're gone.
What have you heard a rumor about them acting up?
If I heard a rumor, I'd go ask them.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, you know, unethical usually meant somebody was stealing. But also, I fired at two different times one of my top managers for sexual harassment at a time when it wasn't, I mean, this is the 80s. It's a long time ago. So that crap didn't go in our company. And that's tough. I mean, it's tough to do that, to fire people who are good managers. But you know, I did it.
Well, you talk about in the book, too, once the company was very mature, you had an individual that had sold you on what a great guy he was, and then you started hearing through, I think it was a person that left your company that kind of dropped a dime on him and said, hey, he's not all he is cracked up to be. And that was a situation where you had to make a tough decision because in some ways he was effective, but knowing what you learned about how he wasn't ethical, you made the call to get rid of him.
And also I had to say that I had made a mistake.
Right.
Which is never that comfortable. But I really screwed up with this guy. And this guy was, the style was yes up, no down. Mm-hmm. So it was a great, I mean, he was telling me what I wanted to hear. It's what happened to Richard Nixon, if you've read about that administration. Same kind of stuff. I mean, I hope I was a better guy than Richard Nixon. But anyway, as soon as I found out about it, but my people were afraid to tell me because they were afraid because this guy was between us, and there'd be retribution. So it was a terrible situation, and he was abusing people that I really cared about. So.
Wow. Well, you had speaking of hiring people, you had an unwritten law to not hire MBAs. I won't be offended by that, but that's the...
We it was okay. You could go at night, but you couldn't... It was a kind of company that MBA schools at the time didn't much like.
Right.
Okay. And the principles didn't really work for most business schools at the time. Now, there's been a bit of a change now. Please, I hope. So that's why. But in my experience then of people who got out of MBA school is they thought they knew a lot more than they knew. They'd come roaring out of there, real cowboys, and ready to change the world. And that was not what was really going to happen.
Right. And you had some bad experiences with consultants, which is not uncommon to have a bad experience with a consultant. And I do agree with you. I think MBAs it's evolved. I think it's evolved as a profession and as a way of teaching, especially entrepreneurial programs, I think, are a bit more refined than they used to be.
Much more refined.
Yeah.
More refined.
I don't like MBAs either. So. I think we have another question up here in the front.
Hello. I really liked your book, by the way.
Thank you.
So I'm curious.
Tell your friends. Tell your enemies.
I did. I brought a friend. Well, so you say that you found it really frustrating when you met people that had a lot of talents but wouldn't focus on a single one. Did you ever feel that way about yourself? And if so, what other talents
do you... I'm not that talented. That's a problem. I knew people who were too talented. I've known several of them. I mean, just, they could do everything, but they could never focus on one thing because they could do so many different things. I didn't have that problem. Really.
And I was wondering if you could tell us another elevator story that isn't in the book.
One that's not in the book. You know, I can't think of anything. I remember, which one did I put in the book? I can't even remember.
Shriver, you ratted out Arlene. About
That's true. Well, one, you know, in light of sexual mores today, might be, one of the most fun things was to be on a crowded elevator with another guy, and just as I was going to get off, and he would stay on, give him a big kiss, and get off the elevator. Just really, it was fairly harmless stuff. You know.
So let's do we'll get the next question for the audience queued up. Let's do quick sort of word association, and feel free to tell as many stories you want about any of these people. But one thing that I found fascinating about the book is just the number of people you end up establishing, in some cases, really great friendships with these celebrities. And sometimes it was a 10-minute conversation, which you do a great job of explaining those little vignettes. So, and some of these are my idols, okay, guys? Like Sam Cooke. So you had an interesting little interaction with Sam Cooke in a small little club while he was on his way up?
Well, actually, it was at a National Guard armory.
Oh, okay.
At that time in North Carolina, there was a law, if you can believe this, that said you could not integrate a dance floor. So there would be these big dances, and then there would be 2,000 African-American people dancing, but then they'd have a white balcony. It was very strange. And so Arlene and I would be some of the 10 or 15 people in the white balcony. So we're sitting up there, and we can't have any fun go down except to hear the acts. And because my uncle had this record store, and we used to sell tickets to the dances, I knew all the promoters of the shows, so I got them to take me backstage to meet all these wonderful people. There was a circuit called the Chitlin' Circuit in North Carolina, and James Brown and Sam Cooke and Otis Redding and Chuck Berry and Fats Domino, everybody played. So I would get to go back and meet them, and they couldn't get over this white kid was interested in their music. I mean, and they were wonderful to me. So I was backstage with this Sam Cooke, who was the greatest R&B singer ever. He died young, sadly, and we were talking, and I told him that my girlfriend was out front. And he said, well, let's go. So we went out front, and I got to introduce him to Arlene, which was really cool. You know, it was neat for a kid. I was probably 16, 17 years old at the time.
So you went from nerd status.
Yeah,
super cool.
Yeah.
I mean, dude, you were sitting there drinking moonshine with Benny King and Tina Turner. Like, how do you do that at 16? Like, what's left?
It was really cool. Yeah. And they treated me like an equal, you know, because I was interested in music. And it was at a time when most white people never heard that kind of music.
Right.
The early days of R&B were just wonderful. If y'all haven't heard much of it, you ought to go back and listen. Stuff from the 60s.
Yeah, there's some great documentaries that are rolling out now. There's one from Muscle Shoals, which just came out. It's fantastic.
20 Feet from Stardom. Have you seen that?
No.
It's about backup singers.
Oh, okay.
It is wonderful.
I will watch that. Yeah. 20 Feet from Stardom. I'll check that out. I think we have another question queued up here. Yeah.
Can you guys hear me? All right, awesome. So I was wondering if you could maybe like touch on some of your like failures or things that you kind of regret when like how you dealt with them and kind of like learned from those experiences.
Well, the biggest one was this guy I was talking about, hiring this guy. He was a psychologist. He'd never had any business experience particularly. He was a consultant. And I decided, I was bored running a company, so I decided it would be fun to just see what he'd do. actually almost bankrupted us. So that was my biggest screw up ever. But we had lots of them. I got us into the gourmet food business because I thought it'd be interesting to see whether you could sell gourmet foods in a mall, not freestanding. You know, that screwed up. I mean, it was terrible. We had a couple stores and lost a bunch of money. We got into wholesaling one time, and our business in retail was, retail's great. You sell somebody something, they pay you, and you got the money. So wholesaling is a receivables business. We had to get paid, and we couldn't get paid. We screwed up there. I got a whole list. I can go on forever.
I kind of got another question also.
Sure.
So, like, as an entrepreneur, like, we kind of think on, like, a smaller level. Like, you know, we start, like, a retail store, or we start from, like, the ground. How do you, like, get your, like, mind thinking bigger, like, trying to, like, pursue, like, manufacturing and, like getting the next level up? Do you get what I'm saying?
You do it for a while. Then you start. You don't think big at first. Think what you're doing at first until you learn how to do it and do it enough times. And then you start to think bigger. But for us, like it took us 5 years to get ready to expand at all, and then a little bit at a time. So I was talking about earlier, the group I was talking to, entrepreneurship is not for everybody. I think maybe half of 1% of the population ought to really work for themselves. So really think about it, because if you can't go home at night and go to sleep, you don't want to be an entrepreneur. If you're going to go home and stare at the ceiling and worry about can you make payroll, or you will just eat yourself alive and you won't be very good at it. So I think most people are happier working for somebody else because you got to be a risk taker. You got to be about half nuts to be an entrepreneur. And for every Mark Zuckerberg story, there are an awful lot of them that don't pan out. So think about it. It sounds like, wouldn't it be great to have my own business? I won't have to work as hard. But in fact, you have to work a lot harder. And you take a lot of risk and responsibility. You glance back over your shoulder to see, you know, who's back there is going to do something. And there's never anybody there. It's you. You do it.
Yeah, I think entrepreneurship's a mental disorder.
Yeah,
just not, because it makes so much more sense just to get a job. Like, why the hell would you want to?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or at least have that stress.
It was something that ran in my family. Grandparents were Russian immigrants, so they didn't have a choice. They had to be entrepreneurs. They sold produce, and my father got into the wholesale grocery business. So it was a natural thing in my family. But I don't think it's natural in most families.
Yep. But I think if it's natural in you, you'll know it. I think you look back at your past and you'll realize I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. So it's usually self-evident when you really look at what you've done as a child and on your way up to graduating from college.
Yeah, I always was doing something. I was managing bands. I always had a couple of things going.
Yep. So a little bit more of the name game. So Willie Nelson, was he like full-on reefer madness? Like, I can't imagine talking to him when he wasn't high. Did you?
Well, I'm sure he was high, but he didn't seem like he was high. Yeah. Did you see he got a black belt, fifth-degree black belt this week in some
Willie
martial
Nelson?
Art? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool.
Or maybe he just thought he got it.
I saw the pictures. But
what was he like?
He was absolutely wonderful. I've always loved Willie. I think he's about as fine an interpreter of other people's music as anybody around. And it's funny because he used to be a great writer, but he hasn't written in a long time. And I heard somebody ask him why, and he said because he smokes too much dope.
Listen to that, kids.
Yes. But he was wonderful. I mean, I met him. He asked me, it was backstage, so it was loud, and he asked me my name again. And he looked me in the eye, and he asked me some questions. It was really cool. It was like a true interaction. Most times you meet celebrities, and that's it. But he was terrific.
And so George Harrison, I think you said you had a pretty positive experience with him.
George was also terrific. I was around George a couple of times, and once at a convention in Acapulco, we spent a bunch of time with him, and he was terrific.
In the presence of a Beatle, amazing.
Yeah, that was exciting. I remember the first time I met him was in London. I was thinking, man, I'm not here if it's not for this guy. You know,
right?
It was pretty cool.
The whole industry could say that.
Yeah.
Next question. Yep.
Hi. I just wondered, did you or your wife ever miss the time when you were a small record company or record store?
After we got bigger?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, working in record stores is way more fun than being a CEO. I mean, seriously. I used to hate sitting at a desk talking on the telephone. I'd do anything. I'd get up, pace down the halls, do anything. And when we had 180 stores, I used to go out once a month and just go work in the store for a day, which was really cool. And that way I could get back to the consumers, and I could also talk to the people who work for the company. And I really enjoyed it. And then we'd go out drinking at night. But I wasn't any good in the store. I couldn't even run a register. But kids who worked in the stores thought that was pretty cool. Which is when I watch the show Undercover CEO, or that show pisses me off. That I mean, I would be so embarrassed if I could go even with a bad disguise into one of our stores and they wouldn't recognize me. Come on, what kind of CEO is that? You really got to have a great touch for your company, great feel to be able to do that. Television. Yeah.
So, Barry, you had your own corollary to the Peter Principle. And for those of you out there that may not know, the Peter Principle basically says that you're going to keep advancing in your career to the point where you're incompetent. So you're finally going to get a job where you just can't do your job anymore. So you had a corollary to that. What was the corollary, and how did that come about?
It was in my experience, and I saw it happen in our company, that somebody who was competent at one level of the company's growth as the company grew, they couldn't do the job. They became incompetent, and that was terrible, because they were in a position that you could. I didn't believe in demoting people, so inevitably they had to leave, but through no fault of theirs except growth of the company. So that's a bad thing. Firing people really sucks. I hated it. I developed all kinds of techniques about firing people. I always fired them in their office so I could get the hell out of there. You know, because when you're going to fire somebody, the only thing they ever hear is you're fired. After that, there is no point in trying to teach somebody anything. And I always took it as a personal defeat, because it was. It was my fault. So, bad thing.
Yep, no doubt about it. We'll get the next question for the audience queued up. I'll ask you, I want to go back to something you said about workaholics and one of the sort of counter business tips or thoughts that you have is you didn't want workaholics working for you. And I like that you kind of came up with an award, the Martyr Award. How did you kind of convey that in a joking fashion, but also as a reminder to people that, look, we're not here to work 100 hours a week. Balance is important.
Well, we developed it when we were first running a record store. And the reason I developed it is because Arlene's sister, her name is Rosalie, and she used to, I mean, she'd always bitch and moan about how hard she was working and all this stuff. So I came up with this award, and she was the only person who ever won it. She won it every week. So we sort of carried on the tradition, you know, because people were always saying, oh, I'm working so hard. And I would say, man, working hard is digging ditches or working on a farm, working in a record store. That's not real hard. I mean, right. that's pretty good stuff.
You know? Right. next question. Yes.
Hi. You talked about getting into a business not for the money, but because you love it, right?
Yeah.
And once money becomes big, a big part of that business, what are some healthy ways to keep it fun and so that you still love that thing?
Well, first of all, don't let the money become the end-all, be-all, all right? And the money's great. I really like making a lot of money because I love the toys, and I still like the toys. I mean, I get to live in Santa Barbara. That's cool. And so you just can't – I like making money in business because that's how you keep score, okay? So, and I'm competitive. So it was important to me to make money, but not just to accumulate it, not just to have it. So it never was that important to me. I worry way more about it now that I don't work than I ever did then. Because now, you know, but then I didn't care at all, except as a scorecard.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's so true. It sounds like a cliche, but the money just won't sustain you. It really won't. It might be what you think you're getting into some kind of a startup career for. You won't last if that's really what your motivation is. You have to have intrinsic.
But driving a Ferrari will get you around, let me tell you.
Yeah, driving a Ferrari is not bad.
Yeah.
But that won't get you up, you know, night after night or morning after morning.
I don't know. Occasionally in the morning.
Damn it, you're rich. I'm talking about before you got rich.
Yeah, right.
So one thing you talk about in your book is allowing people to invent their own jobs. That's intriguing. So do you have some examples? Can you recall where you did it and it really, really worked?
I did it all the time. When I'd hire somebody, I mean, okay, they got a job, and there's a certain amount of things you got to do. But within the parameters that of that job, everybody invents their own job. They make it fit them. So what I tried to do with my people is I would say, look, you know what you're doing. I'm here. If you need me, I'm down the hall. Come in, drink a cup of coffee. Come ask me questions. Do that, and I'll be around. I'll wander around, but I am not going to look over your shoulder. I am not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to micromanage you because there's no point in doing that. If I'm going to do that, I might as well get your salary. I don't need you. So it's your job to figure out how it works. And before somebody got a job, they were competent, or they wouldn't have gotten the job.
Right.
So, and that worked. It was a great. I was the best manager in the world with good people, and the worst with bad people. I couldn't manage. If somebody wasn't any good, I couldn't manage them at all.
Right. Right. Yep. Hire great people and everything else.
Oh yeah. Started, so. Yeah. I was the best manager you ever saw.
So here's. I'm gonna throw you a curveball.
Yeah.
What's your favorite album?
My favorite album. Boy, that.
Albums are these.
Yeah,
CD.
Yeah, right.
What's your
CD.
Favorite downloaded compilation of singles?
You know, probably if I had to pick one that I had to listen to over and over and over, Springsteen's Born in the USA.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, probably. Yeah. That, and maybe Otis Redding live at the live album. That'd be a close second.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you got to know the boss a little bit, right?
He's missed me, and I've missed him several times. Early on, I saw him first time in 1972, and I accepted him as my savior. And we've been chasing him around ever since.
All right, well, if you're watching, come on, Bruce.
Yeah. Yeah. But we started dragging people to his concerts because the music, the first couple albums really were not representative of what he was doing. But once you saw him live, I mean, if y'all haven't seen him live, if you ever get a chance to do it, he's the best I ever saw.
Yeah, and some of the bootlegs and even official releases from the 70s are pretty ridiculous. He'll tell like these 20-minute stories and you're crying.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I thought this was a concert. What's going on?
Yeah, but I mean, they rock too.
Yeah.
The band really rocks.
Yeah.
And he does 3.5-hour concerts.
Yeah. Now he's an entertainer.
Yeah.
Next question queued up.
Yes. So in the beginning of your book, you explained like the crux of your philosophy as you're an amoral person, but you also believe in ethics.
Yeah.
Could you clarify that point and also clarify how the pursuit of excellence has really led you to be who you are today?
Well, the amoral part, morals, mores, are handed down societally. And I think ethics are in the cloud someplace. You know, they sort of come down to us. And social mores vary so much from society to society that I just don't think, I mean, you hear this all this stuff about a moral person. Well, what it means within a context of what, Christianity? Or whoever's saying it at a certain time. But it seems to me ethics about things that are really right and wrong are pretty much I understand. So that's why. And the amoral thing is said to piss somebody off. You know? It's good. And now the second question was pursuit of excellence. How's that?
How do you feel like that has really made you who you are today?
I'm just competitive. Yeah, I really like to win. And I don't like to win at all costs, and I don't like to win at the expense of leaving somebody dying in the dirt, but I like to win. So, I compete on the tennis court. It's the same thing. And I think that's where the pursuit of excellence came from. I'm competitive. I want to show everybody I'm the best.
So management by inclusion, how did that come about, and how did you use that in the company as it grew?
It made sense. Okay, it makes sense that if you can get people to feel included, well, I mean, there's all kinds of research. If people feel that they're a part of something, they work harder, they're happier, the organizations do better.
So how did you do that? How did you?
So what we tried to do was set up feedback loops so people at the bottom of the company could get messages to the people at the top of the company. And we did it with committees. But one of the things I did was I said to everybody in the company, hell, if you want to talk to me, call me up, tell me something. And the first phone calls, I mean, I'd always have a call list. And the first phone call I always take from somebody from our stores, because I was really interested in what they had to say. And I mean, you can't react to everything. You ask an organization full of people, what can we do better? The first thing that everybody's going to say is pay us more money. I mean, you know that's coming. But we were interested in that too. We also got great stuff. We never ever put in a system for our stores without setting up a group of store managers to work with systems people to create the system together, instead of handing it down from up top and having everybody be pissed off about the new system. And it really worked a lot better that way. And as much as we could, we tried to include people. It's hard when you get bigger.
Right. And at the peak, how many employees do you think you guys had?
A couple thousand.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I think the theme you guys see in the book is, as long as Barry and Arlene were sort of hands-on operators, going to the stores once a week, taking phone calls from employees, when you stepped away, that's when problems arose. When you brought in the psychologist, or you thought, okay, we're at the point where we should hire professional managers.
Yeah, people give lip service to it, but not many people really believe that.
Right, you know? Right.
Who wants to have some store manager tell you you're stupid? But, you know,
I think it takes incredible guts to say, yeah, just give me a call, and then start taking the calls.
Well, we did this thing with bounce-back cards, you know, the kind of cards you give to somebody, and they send it back to, and they're all addressed as CEO. And I read them all. I thought there was nothing I could do more important than read these things. And we had a contest about the cards. The people who worked for it, they in the stores, they had to hand them to the customer. They couldn't just stuff them in a bag. And we had a contest, and the way the contest was, it was all about quantity. The person who got the most cards sent back to me won a weekly prize, a monthly prize, and it got, I mean, the yearly thing was a lot of money. And the reason there was stuff on there to fill out about what the service was like and everything. But the reason we did it on a quantitative basis, I figured somebody had to be really stupid to hand a customer a card and then give them bad service. It just didn't make any sense. So I figured that was a way we could get our people to give really good customer service. And it seemed to work. So, and I, like I said, I read all the cards. And boy, I used to get some cards. Woo, I got some beauties. Threaten my life. I mean, stuff
wow.
like that. Didn't get good service. I mean.
So that was pre-Yelp, back before you could look
yeah,
up.
Yeah. By the way, there's a very active website on Facebook called the Cult of Record Bar. It's still people that work for us. I mean, there are a lot of people on there. And they all talk about what a great company was.
Well, you guys have had reunions.
Yeah. And a lot of people show up, even people who got fired. It was a hell of a place to work for. I mean, it was our toy. We ran it the way we wanted to.
Well, you would bring in artists. Yeah. I think Lyle Lovett came in. You would bring in artists that were on their way up.
Well, once a year we'd have a company convention, usually in Hilton Head. We did it in Nashville and L.A. And we brought in, I mean, it was like a four-day party. And major rock and roll, major acts. It was pretty cool. Yeah. I mean, all of our store managers, and we paid for their spouses to come. Because we tried to make it a family company, so the spouses would be happy that their people were working for us, too.
Right.
And that worked.
You guys should be having fun wherever you're working, honestly. It's not, like I've said, it's not like Mad Men. It's not like the TV shows.
Don't work someplace that you don't like.
Yeah.
Don't do that. I mean, you spend way too much of your time at work. Find some place you like, because you won't be any good if you don't like it.
Right. And those places are out there. You just have to look. So, dude, you were high when you met Jimmy Carter. What was that about? And did he know
Why?
You were high?
Me? Yeah. Well, he might have known Arlene was. It was the first, if Carter had just become the leading candidate, we went to a small cocktail party. We were walking, we smoked a joint before we went. Stupid. We're walking down the hall, and all these guys are talking into their lapels, and we're going, they know, they know.
They know.
Right. And so we get to the party, and there's all these flash bulbs popping. We meet Carter, and we're talking to him, and he says something to Arlene, and he was asking her, and Arlene's going, yes, yes. I said, Chapel Hill. He asked her where we were from. And she was going, yes, yes. Don't get stoned before you meet the president.
You heard it first here.
Yeah.
So were there, you met a lot of celebrities. Were there any that you met and you were just completely disappointed? Like, really? Dude, that's what you're about?
One of the things that's really interesting about that is the people who are really jerks pretty much disappear quickly because nobody wants to deal with them. There was an artist named Dan Fogelberg, which probably I mean, I almost got into a fight with him in the dressing room. He was such a jerk. And there was a guy named Eddie Money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so these people disappeared.
Yeah.
Eddie Money had been a New York cop. He did an in-store for us.
Two hits.
And did an in-store for us in one of our stores, went in the back, smoked a joint. That's a real no-no. Did some cocaine. And then stole a cassette on his way out. So, I mean, he was the kind of guy you really wanted to go out and work hard for, try to really sell some
right.
stuff, you know.
Shoplifted in your store.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, but I mean, those people disappeared, and there are a few others too.
Yep. Yeah. Well, so you do talk about some celebrities in the book. Were there any celebrity stories that you want to share with us that weren't in the book?
We've met a bunch of people. Boy, the coolest one since then, probably. I'm a big tennis fan, so we met Roger Federer, who was just wonderful. We were at Indian Wells at the tournament, and the tournament director took us back to the players' lounge to meet him. And he's standing there waiting for us, and we walk up, and he puts out his hand and says, "Hi, I'm Roger." I went, "No shit, you know? Who knew?" So, but it was, that was really cool. He was great. We talked for a long time. He was asking us questions about who we were and everything.
I hope you had a little throwdown with him on the court. Did you?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So your meeting with Bob Dylan was kind of interesting. You were, I don't want to tell the story, but anyway, you met with him and he sort of started asking you questions that you were a little bit surprised by.
I met him at a cocktail party, and talked to him for about an hour. And he was just changing record companies. He had a new record coming out, and he was really, and he asked me questions about marketing and sales for about an hour. And I kept thinking, this is the most surreal conversation because this is the poet laureate of our time, but he wants to talk about making money. Yeah. It was very impressive.
The times are changing.
And look at Dylan. Dylan's one of the best marketing people who ever lived.
Yeah.
Because he changes, and he's kept his career alive till today.
Yeah, he's no dummy.
No, smart guy.
So 25 years in the music industry, kind of got to the top of that. You climbed that mountain. What made you make the leap into a completely different industry, different market, different product, cosmetics?
The day after we sold the company, I said, man, I want to get in the cosmetics business. Not really. It was about a year later, and this friend of mine was a Harvard B School graduate. And he had been an investment banker in New York, and he wanted to do something entrepreneurially. And so I said, and I liked him. I mean, he was a good guy, young guy. And I said, I'll give you some money. Go find something. And he found Bare Essentials. And I didn't know anything about the cosmetics business. I knew something about how to run a company and how to sell things. So it turned out Harvard B School wasn't real good training to run a cosmetics company. So that's when I got more involved. I was going to be passive. And the better it got, the more involved I became because then I started protecting my investment. So I learned something about the cosmetics business. But I don't know much about it.
Well, then you hired Within and got an incredible CEO.
Luckily, my friend who I'd started the company with went off to run a public company and left me kind of in the lurch, and I needed a CEO badly, and we had a merchandiser in place, and her name was Leslie Blodgett, and I said, be the CEO, and she said, no, I can't do it. I've never run anything. I don't know how to run anything. So I said, I'll teach you how to be CEO. You sell this stuff. And she did. She's a genius. And she's walked away to this point from Bear Essentials with a couple hundred million dollars. So
wow.
She did okay. I taught her well. I'm still waiting for my check in the mail. But, it's coming.
Maybe Bruce Springsteen will bring it to you.
Yeah.
We have time for two more questions from the audience. If you want to get those queued up, raise your hand if you want the microphone. Let's talk about Bear Essentials a little bit more. What, in that interim period before you had the CEO, or maybe even afterwards, what were some of the biggest challenges for you, the former record executive, in this whole entirely new market?
We were trying as best we could not to bring in extra money. Okay, we were trying to keep the ownership for ourselves. So we really ran it lean. And there were some days when my friend really wanted to bring in some money. And I kept saying, if we can get through this, we'll be a lot happier. And we were a lot happier. Because when we finally sold the thing, we owned it. And we had gone back and bought as much back as we could. So it was just us and a group of friends when we finally did sell it.
So keep it and capitalized appropriately without.
Yeah, that's really hard. So if y'all do something entrepreneurially, and VC money is awful expensive money, and on the way up, keep as much of it as you can, run it as lean as you can, and that'll mean you're going to get some phone calls from creditors or stuff. But if you got something and it's good, hang on to it as much as you can. And it's hard to do, but it really pays off if you ever get that public offering or somebody shows up with a check.
Right. Up front.
Yeah.
Hello.
You're on.
There we go. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Just a question. You talked about how you were able to learn about this one gentleman, the psychology. The guy with the degree in psychology, through reports from your employees, and how after that experience did you institute ways, as communication can go up and down, and then laterally, how did you institute any mechanisms of reaching down to that bottom level employee and finding out what's going on the ground?
I just made damn sure I didn't hire another bad guy. Because we had the communication up and down, but it just was getting stopped. Okay, so, and that was just purely because of the person, and which is an abject lesson. One person can screw up a company, or one person can make it. I mean, it only takes one. I believe in a pyramidal form of management, and companies. It's a top-down theory that as long as you hire good people. And you hire them, you can go all the way down. And in our stores, I could go in the stores, and people were a lot like me. They were younger, but they, you know, it was the same core values. But unfortunately, the pyramid, you can really screw it up. You hire one asshole, and everybody below them on the pyramid's an asshole. Yeah, so you got to really be careful.
And well, in that instance, you had to get rid of more than just the one guy because he had hired people like himself.
Well, he had screwed up, and some of my other people had screwed him up. So there was one day, it was a real bad day to get caught in the halls because I fired the entire senior management of the company. I mean, it was my fault. I had screwed it up, but they were too far gone. It just had screwed up everything, so.
Last student question here in the front. Yes.
You describe some of the artists as bigger than life, for example, Michael Jackson. So can you tell us a little more about the time you met him and what your favorite song is off the Bad album?
I want to know about the monkey. Forget about Michael.
And the monkey.
Yeah. I like the Man in the Mirror. That's my favorite song off that. There wasn't a whole lot of Michael there. You know, I met him, but it was like he was there, but he wasn't there. And I don't know if he was doing drugs or whatever. It was like sort of that. The presence was on stage. The presence was in the recording studio. It was never on a one-to-one basis. And there was something bad in that family, something real bad. And his father, I mean, he's got devil eyes, you know, Joe Jackson. And I knew LaToya pretty well, and she was the same way. There was something that happened to the family. So the person I met was not the person on stage. It was a totally different person. But it was interesting. The one thing that was in his house that was so extraordinary, there was a room in the whole, there were all three walls were decoupaged with pictures of Michael Jackson and everybody in the world. All the presidents, all the popes, all the world leaders, everybody wanted to have their picture taken with Michael Jackson. And it gave me you can't have a concept of what it's like for those people until you see something like that. And that's not the real world. That's not like anything. You know. It's an interesting place.
So a couple things you said, we'll wrap it up with this last question. You talk about the theory of hanging around, and I'd like to hear you kind of talk about how that fits in with your one of the other words of advice you have, which is do what you want to do.
Well, I think hanging around, if you don't hang around, which means work. I've been an overnight success twice in my life. One time it took 14 years, and the other time it took 25. Okay, it takes a long time. And today, everybody wants to be rich by Thursday, but that's really not the way it works. You have to hang around. And if you hang around long enough, you might be in the right place when something real good happens. And I've been there a couple times. And it's because it took a while to get there, but I was there. And what was the other
one? Do what you want to do.
Do what you want.
So while you're hanging around, make sure you're doing what you want to do.
Be happy, because it's about the journey. It's really not about the end. It's enjoy your lives. And my experience was that successful people were successful at home, and they were successful in business. I like people with balance, and I like people who had successful family lives. And so I recommend that to you. Don't let a company chew you up and make you work too much. And find a company that understands about that people have other lives.
Well, like I said at the outset, you are the living embodiment of that. So is Arlene. The fact that you have had multiple successes, you're still extremely grounded. I know because we're friends. You're an extremely grounded and humble person, and you have maintained success both personally and professionally. So I really, really do appreciate you coming in and sharing your story with our students.
This is a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.